This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett. Dr. Sue Wareham, President of the Medical Association for the Prevention of War, on the developments at the Australian War Memorial. Dr. Benoit Campmark, Digest Pauline Hanson. Mike Kissam, Vice Chairperson of Australian Friends of Palestine Association, with his journey for Palestine, and also not-so-subtle censorship by the Israeli lobby and the Australian government. And delving into the recent past for this, our 50th anniversary program, with Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees and former manager of Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, Jessica Morrison, with, of course, the focus on Palestine. But Mr. Kevin Healy is here for the last day of the financial year, and we'll see what tricks he's got up his sleeve.
A weak Jan Lisner went top marks to the Reserve Losses Bank for standing up for its principles. Principles that the solution to inflation is wage restraint and higher unemployment. It's got nothing to do with the caring business class or caring business class greed. No, it's all down to the workers. Too many of them and too many of them wanting to be paid. So good on the Reserve Losses and Supremo Michelle Bulldust for standing up against the money-grabbing greed of their lazy avaricious workforce. So unconcerned over the economy, it, the workforce, claims the bank's 9.5% increase over 3 years is a real wage cut. How fiscally reckless. Their disrespect gets worse. As an organisation full of economists, management obviously knows this. The offer therefore presents a very negative view of the values staff are providing. If the organisation full of economists really cared, they would resign and join the unemployed and or take a wage cut, but no, they put themselves ahead of the need to fight inflation. Selfish, selfish economists. Worse, timely warning from prominent business class party apparatchik Prude Go Hard Against Workers, warning the caring business class party if it does not concentrate on fighting the socialists' caring business class relations laws, the coalition will condemn its business base to bankruptcy. Bankruptcy. Any wonder the filthy rich are shaking in their boots, or, well, their Italian and Swiss leather shoes and boots. Worse, speaking of luxury, a mob called Luxury Escape Supremo Adam Schwab told us the state socialist work-from-home laws will, quote, drive a dagger through the heart of Victoria's sickly business community. And yes, don't the filthy rich look pretty sickly? As we've said a few times, who'd be a caring employer doing her his altruistic bit for society faced with such unrelenting perfidy? Like poor Simon Crew Work Harder grilled the Workers Supremo mentioned last week, despite years of accusations of ripping off workers, Simon assures us his only concern is those workers. And then he's been charged with misleading customers in a promotion to donate to environmental causes. And now he's under attack for a harmless little ad, super buns to brag about, with a bun on a woman's backside. Staff claiming the ad is sexist for no stronger reason than the ad is 100% sexist. He's prepared to use women's bodies as a punchline to sell burgers, the evil union alleged. For goodness sake, that's his job. Even though he cares even more about the workers, as long as they don't demand conditions and pay. Also debate this week. Multiracial is a scavenging vulture threatening our cherished moron culture. Moron culture proving everything's right so long as all of us are white. Although not sure there was much of a debate, as caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremo Angus Tailings couldn't quite get his tongue around the word. Whereas one notions that appalling Hoonson knows all about moron culture. Speaking of morons, her new MP got off to a big start by voting the wrong way, Well, as it turned out, the correct way, but he got confused. Maybe the fact that the motion was in like words confused him, but he apologised, and that appalling assured us he would vote the appalling moron way in future, as long as someone explains to him what the words mean. What a loss to the education system, the demise of the Krish Hands-On Brothers, forced to sell up to meet a percentage of the damages they owe the young men, whose biggest lesson was, don't go near them. Sworn to obey the dictates of the dear baby Jesus, their observance stopped at the dick bit. Interesting they have to sell up, because they have, quote, just $23 million in the bank, they said. That simply highlights the extent of their criminality. They won't be missed, nor will Carl Stefano, voice of rubbish, after eulogising a British neo-fascist, even Channel Ning Nong forced to respond to public opprobrium. One commentator telling us, Carl is riding two horses at once. One is in the centre, another is in the far right lane. And presuming the mindless dribble offered as morning entertainment is in the centre, then the mind boggles at what might be called the right. True to form, that appalling Hoonsal uploaded the neo-fascist interview to her account, shocked poor Carl could be so mistreated. Carl's journalistic balance reflected in his reference to temporary His Most Gracious Majesty's home country Supremo Keir Starmer as a wanker. Proving smart, intelligent, omniscient Carl is no wanker. I read where Carl's dribble, the in-the-centre morning dribble, is trailing the rival channel's morning dribble. I, and I suspect we, listener, can't believe anyone watches either of them. Then again, I saw a photo shoot of the nominees for the so-called Gold Logie and thought, to paraphrase the bard, has our talent and entertainment pool shrunk to this small measure? That appalling's local hero and role model, and almost certainly ditto Carl, our filthiest rich of the filthy rich Gina. It's just one problem after another. Any wonder her Perth offices are tired with wise, thought-provoking quotes from her hero, the filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Elon Must Have More, calling for government to get out of the way and let the filthy rich do what they do best, make themselves filthy richer. Bloody government. Poor Gina's been forced to flog off one of her numerous grazing properties, a little 23,000 hectares, for a mere 60 mil pocket money to Gina, because the Queensland government wants to tax her. Well, tax her Chinese partner a foreign tax surcharge of all of 3%. This is unsustainable from a business perspective, Gina bemoaned. Yes, how cruel, interfering government, because imagine how a 3% tax surcharge must so hurt Gina, a tax surcharge she apparently can't avoid. Yes, better to pocket 60 mil than be hit with a 3% tax. And something that would also hurt her, perhaps not quite as much as it doesn't involve the hip pocket, but still hurt, abrade her faith in the true blue Aussie people. That survey that but 21% trust Gina's hero, US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor, to do the right thing in world affairs. If it's any consolation to Gina and that appalling and Carl, we can guarantee Donald will always do the right thing. But worse, a majority have more faith in evil China. Not that her admiration for Donald prevents her working with her Chinese partners when there's a quid or billion involved. And further consolation, our minister for being offensive and trained killing Richard Mall's the bad guys, he of the giant mind, assured us, America, we assume he means the US old bit of the Americas, remains the cornerstone of our strategic and foreign policy, and the alliance has never been more important. He's so spot on, isn't he? On the other hand, we might question what the 21% who do have faith in Donald were thinking. They're probably busy watching Carl's in-depth interviews. The promised benefits of privatisation of public services, lower prices due to the efficiency of the private sector, highlighted yet again as the electricity regulator announced standing offer reductions of up to 10.7%, guaranteed to lower our bills. Well, not quite. The efficiency of the private sector came to the rescue, with the poor dears forced to increase their supply charges by up to 86%. And what do we know? There go the lower bills. It must so hurt the privatised industry to find it just can't afford to pass on the price cuts. 86%. That's inflation run riot. Further proof of the greed of those reserve losses bank workers. Because the privatised utilities, efficiency, lower prices, could never be accused of greed. Nor could KP on the workers MG for keep profits meagre grand being attacked just because it used incompetent information from clients to make a killing and made a whistleblower's life so miserable he says he would never do it again. Surely keep profits meagre is just doing what it exists to do, make profits meagre. It may face some severe penalties like a temporary pause, say 3 or 4 days, in those multi-billion outsourcing it enjoys from the public purse, allowing it too to bring the efficiency of the private sector to the bloated, inefficient hand of the public sector. Speaking of efficiency, the Mineral Profits Council's Tania Constable, profits attacked, noisy activists who would seek to diminish industries like the mining industry and regional Troubler Aussie, after the anti-Troubler Aussie Spoil Sport Troubler Aussie Institute warned of dodgy carbon offsetting, as if there's something dodgy about planting a tree somewhere and polluting to your big heart's content. The efficiency of the offset system proven by a Shell on the Planet Gas facility in Western Troubler Aussie, earning more than $90 million in carbon credits, real figure, while increasing its emissions by 400,000 tonnes, real figure. To prove its credentials, Shell said it supports measures for Troubler Aussie to be a net zero economy. Little measures like 90 mil in the kick and 400,000 tonnes on Mother Earth. Finally, Tania was in Canberra launching a hands-off our fuel campaign aimed at preventing the government touching the industry's fuel tax rebate, which costs the public purse a mere $13 billion a year, a small price for Mother Earth to pay. Good afternoon.
And that was Mr. Kevin Healy with his Week That Was. And don't forget, he's there again on the airwaves tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, with City Limits, here on 3CR.
The New International Bookshop's Big Red Book Fair is back for 2026. We'll have thousands of second-hand books for super low prices and 20% off new books, plus many other cool things. This is a great moment to support Melbourne's longest-running left bookshop. I'll see you on Saturday, the 18th of July, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Trades Hall, 54 Victoria Street, Carlton. Can't wait to see you there. The New International Bookshop is a 3CR supporter. Did you know that each donation over $2 you make to 3CR's Radiothon is tax deductible? That means that when you're doing your tax return business, you can claim your 3CR donation as a legitimate tax deduction. To make a pledge to this year's Radiothon, call the station on 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au/donate.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Last week, a new gallery of the Australian War Memorial was unveiled. The four surviving VC holders were invited to attend. Three answered the call. No guesses who the one who stayed away was, for whatever reason. I spoke with the president of the Medical Association for the Prevention of War, Sue Wareham, who said that there's not enough information being put forward at the moment about the progress of the new development of the memorial, And she suggested instead that we concentrate on a report on the memorial's programming for children. Quote, young Australians deserve something better than the existing narrative on endless war, unquote. The report is Time to Talk Peace, the Australian War Memorial and Children, which was put out by the Medical Association for the Prevention of War. So the fact is that tens of thousands of children, school children, attend the memorial every month, and that increases the importance of a proper story being told.
Yes, there are about 100,000 school kids in groups visit the War Memorial each year. It's a thing that a lot of kids do, and that's fine, it's good. There's a government, Commonwealth government program called the PACER, which is Parliamentary and Civics Education Rebate, which helps the schools financially to bring children to Canberra, and that's very good. It's a good program. But because of that, it's so important that what the War Memorial offers to children when they go is appropriate for them and is helping them to think critically about the issues that will be presented, and that it's not just an opportunity to present a single narrative about Australia's wars, which often tends to play up. I'm hesitant to use the word glorify. A lot of people reject that, but there's a tendency to play up the importance of the wars that Australia has been involved in, and up to a point that's quite appropriate. But Memorial has a line at the end of the World War One gallery, which is something along the lines of, all nations have their story, this is our story. And so it's more or less putting out the view that Australia going to war is the most important thing that Australia has ever done, and by implication, the kids need to be prepared to keep on doing this because it's central to our identity. And that's the notion that really needs challenging. We would hope that when children visit the War Memorial, they would learn some military history, that's appropriate. But they also need to learn about the full impact of wars, including particularly on civilians, because it's civilians who bear the brunt disproportionately by quite a wide margin of modern wars. And if kids are not getting the full picture about that and other implications of warfare, then it's not a satisfactory education for them about Australia's wars, and that's what troubles us.
Let's expand on that. Quote, young Australians deserve something better than the existing narrative on endless war. What is that narrative? If you just explain, what is missing, or is there more?
Well, the narrative about Australia's wars and involvement in warfare, a lot of it hinges on the ANZAC narrative. There have been a number of eminent historians who write about it as a myth, the ANZAC myth, ANZAC legend, this sort of terming. But the proponents of it, and the key one who's now left the memorial's director, was Dr. Brendan Nelson, who was director up until he's the immediate past director of the memorial, and he was frequently speaking about the ANZAC, whatever word he used, tradition or whatever, as being a central part of what Australia stands for. Whereas, in fact, as a number of historians, Marilyn Lake and others, have written about, Australia has such a rich, rich history of democratic reforms and labour reforms and other things in which we were actually world leaders, which one could legitimately argue should and are and should be seen as an extremely important part of our history. And we shouldn't forget also the frontier wars. And on that matter, I will say that the memorial, just in very recent times, is making some comments about recognising, I'm not sure about commemorating, but at least recognising the frontier wars better than they have in the past, which has been virtually negligible in the past. But the frontier wars are such an important part of Australia's history that school kids need to learn about, and the Woolmore is an appropriate place for that to happen too. The messages that we believe are missing from the memorial are, as I mentioned, information about the full impact of wars on civilians. The memorial does that up to a point, but it doesn't do it sufficiently. It needs to be covered far more thoroughly. And what's really missing is any prompts for the children to think about, well, why did this war happen? Who made the decisions? Why was the decision made? What was the context? What was the history leading up to it? And how could this war have been avoided? And that's what's really missing from the memorial. And we believe that's a big gap in what they're presenting to children.
Well, this report by the Medical Association for the Prevention of War is called Time to Talk Peace, the Australian War Memorial and Children. Who were those who put it together?
It was members of Medical Association for Prevention of War, people very experienced in children's welfare, psychology, that sort of thing. So it was just a small group of us who wrote it, and that report came out a while back, and we've since had another one called PACER. PACER was the program I mentioned by which school groups come to Canberra, PACER for Peace, and that's again looking at some questions which the memorial could and should be prompting children to think about, and also other places in Canberra where a focus on peace could readily be sort of built into plans for school trips to Canberra.
How would the contents of this report be presented to children who come to the memorial?
The main thing that our organisation, Medical Association for Prevention of War, has been advocating over a couple of years or so now is that in developing the children's galleries, given that the whole memorial is undergoing a huge expansion, a significant part of it, part of which has just opened up, but they haven't yet come to the children's galleries, the new children's galleries. And we've been trying to find out, well, what stage is the planning for these at? And we're not getting any information on that at the moment. But we're advocating particularly that there be an advisory group for children of outside experts to work with the gallery development team to make sure that what they're presenting to children is appropriate coverage of Australia's wars, and that prompts the sorts of questions that children need to be thinking about when they think about our wars. And we haven't been able to make any progress. The memorial is not forthcoming in engaging on that matter at the moment. So we're still working on that.
How many gallery are there already at the memorial devoted to children?
Before COVID, there was an area in the memorial. This was the old memorial, and it was also before the major expansion got underway. There was an area called the Discovery Zone, and it was pretty much a play area. And that, in fact, was what has really prompted our concerns and kicked off our concerns about what the memorial was teaching children about war. It was a play area. They could go and play in a fake World War One trench or pretend they were hunting a Soviet submarine, playing in a Vietnam era helicopter. It was really, as far as education goes, it was really quite a disgrace. So that closed with COVID, and no new children's space has opened up yet. And so we're told that it's going to be open next year, 2027 to 2028. But so that being the case, then we would expect that planning would be well underway. But it's hard to get that input to the memorial.
I'm just wondering whether there has been a survey of children in the past as to what they get out of or don't get out of a visit to the memorial.
The memorial themselves, I think, have probably done surveys. I'm pretty sure there haven't been any surveys done by people other than the memorial, but it would be a valuable tool to have, certainly.
So have you got a guarantee that this report will be published and used by the memorial, or is this something you're just putting forward and hoping that they will take it on?
We sent it to the memorial, and as I mentioned, it was published a while ago. So they've certainly received it, but no, there's not any guarantee at all that that they will take any of it on board. I think they'll probably look at it out of curiosity, if nothing else, but no guarantee of what they'll do with it.
What about comparable war memorials in other countries? Do they have an emphasis on children? Looking at peace in a wider perspective, your paper says that peace funding is going down. It's deliberately going down while defence spending is going up. And it's to an enormous amount of money in the last few years. And I imagine that you in as your work with MAPW, couldn't have imagined that the budget for defence and war would be so huge today and increasing.
Well, it is quite alarming. It's extremely alarming. Australia's military budget is over for the current year, or for the 2026-27 figure, is going to be over $60 billion. In fact, over $63 billion. And what's equally alarming is that is projected to go up and up and up, keep going up over the next decade until it's nearly double that. So within a decade's time, so by 2035-36, we're told that it's going to be around $112 billion. So these are just absolutely astonishing figures. AUKUS will be part of that, but it's more than AUKUS. It's a total focus on military preparedness at the preparedness for what, we're not exactly told, but military capacity at the expense of other things, and those other things would be things that really make us secure as a nation. We need to be ramping up our climate action, and given that the Australian government is concerned about relationships with the Pacific, then ramping up our climate action and making that absolute priority, along with nuclear weapons, I should add, that would really go, really create good relationships in the Pacific for Australia. And looking after Australians' health, education, housing, all of these things, the environment, would make us far more secure.
You could even say give peace a chance, in, as the song says, but we're battling against the tide, aren't we?
We are indeed, with so much funding going within the education system and elsewhere to military projects. We are really battling against the tide. Peace research centres at Australian universities used to be more numerous and far better resourced than they are at the moment, but funding for peace research has just been whittled away over not just recent years, a longer time frame than that. It's just been whittled away as our military budget goes up and up and the world becomes more violent. So we really need to take a step back. If the government is serious about peace, and they toss in the word peace whenever it seems appropriate, but if they're serious about peace, they need to commit to it and commit to the training and the funding that it needs, because peace doesn't just break out miraculously when there's nothing much going on. It really needs hard work, in fact, much harder work. It's much harder to build peace than it is to build weaponry and train armies. But it's more challenging and in fact, almost certainly a more important task in terms of our security.
And as we were talking about children before, it's they who are being targeted for these educational pushes for defence?
Yes, indeed. Certainly at universities, the Defence Department related projects and weapons company linked projects are quite prolific through our universities, right through the tertiary sector. But even at schools, in secondary schools, and even down to primary schools, we've got federal government and some state government funded programs to encourage kids to get really excited about building nuclear submarines or about building missiles. And this is not the sort of thing we want our kids excited about if we want a peaceful, secure future. Australia's premier organisation for promoting our best young scientific minds is NYSF, which is the National Youth Science Forum. And they have good programs, great programs, but their primary sponsor is the world's biggest weapons maker, i.e. Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin branding is all three of their events. So kids are getting the message that science is good and, oh, Lockheed Martin, that looks like a good company, the weapons industry. They're exciting. They're offering all sorts of opportunities. I might get to that.
Well, when we started, it was the Australian War Memorial and you're talking about those weapons companies. Well, they're featured widely in the memorial.
If you walk through the memorial, you wouldn't actually see prominent mention of the weapons companies. They are mentioned there, but that's not the point. As you noted, the memorial still receives funding from the weapons industry, and they say that the memorial says that they determine the programs, they're not influenced by where the funding comes from, but one can't really totally believe that 100%. I mean, if you've got an eye to where your funding is coming from and which organisation doesn't, then you're going to be a bit influenced by what that organisation might expect. And organisations, when they do give funding to the memorial, will receive some benefits, which might be naming rights. And, for example, the theatre in the War Memorial, which is used for lectures, events, that sort of thing, has been fairly recently named the Boeing, pretty sure it's Boeing, the Boeing Theatre. Some years back it was the BAE Theatre, and then it was that BAE branding was removed from it, so it was just the War Memorial Theatre or something like that. Now it's the Boeing Theatre. And the War Memorial, just in recent days, have announced a new podcast about some of the, I forget the exact title, it's something like some of the hidden costs of war or hidden truths behind war, something of that nature. And it's sponsored by Leidos, which is also a part of the weapons industry. And it's all about military experiences of warfare. And that's legitimate. It's what the memorial does. But if you're going to look at the hidden costs of war or hidden truths within war, then you've got to look at civilians. You've got to look at a whole range of impacts far beyond those of military personnel.
Well, just finally, Sue, the hidden costs of this war memorial development or redevelopment?
Cost of the expansion of the war memorial and redevelopment, the last I saw it was still at $550 million, which is a huge amount of money considering what those sorts of funds could do for a number of the things that I mentioned, health, education, but also for veterans' welfare. I mean, even within the veterans community, this expenditure on a vast redevelopment building, which is telling a pretty narrow story of what war is all about. It's a huge amount of money. But nevertheless, it seems to be that whatever the memorial asks for, then that's what they will receive from government.
And that's even more reason why people should keep their eye on it and just check what's happening and make sure that it doesn't keep on expanding and expanding.
Well, yes, I think once the current plans are completed, I don't think there's any scope for further expansion. But what we need to be really, really mindful of and watch carefully is the nature of the exhibits, and particularly not only for children, but particularly for children. What messages are kids getting when they go through the memorial? Is it that war is an exciting opportunity? And I should say there that the memorial has also engaged an advertising company to create multimedia sort of materials for children. Goodness knows what that's going to look like when it's in place. So we really need to guard against the notion that war is exciting, and also what was done previously, as I mentioned, in the former Discovery Zone at the memorial, it was actually presented as fun. These are the war games you can play. That's just such a dangerous development in terms of children's education, and that's what we need to be guarding against.
Thanks for today, Sue.
Thank you very much, Jan.
And Dr. Sue Wareham is the President of the Medical Association for the Prevention of War.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday, the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
Pauline Hanson has been in politics in Australia at all levels, beginning as a councillor, Ipswich City Council, in 1995. Then moved to Member of Parliament for Oxley, and finally as Senator for Queensland since 2016. Always controversial, a short stint in jail in 2013. I'm joined now by Binoy Campmark, Senior Lecturer at RMIT University, to explain the phenomenon of Pauline Hanson. Is it one factor in 2026, or it is a conversion of factors?
Well, there just seems to be a general tendency towards, a suspiciousness towards the ruling authorities of the day. It's been on a kind of a slow burn in Australia, this tendency, which has caught fire and been absolutely blazing away in the United States, in the UK, and in Europe, primarily, in the form of generally, not always, but generally an insurrection of sorts from the right wing of politics, usually in the form of concern about things such as immigration, standard of living, these sorts of things. So these are the sorts of issues that have actually been incubating for quite some time, and it just so happens that there's been a convergence of factors recently about a lot of it, of course, totally conjured up. I mean, a lot of this, there are some genuine issues in the policy mix, but there are some that are simply found in the context of agitation and polemic and all that. So Hanson has capitalized on that. Popularity of parties is at all-time low in Australia. And so she does come across as offering, another voice, even though the voice is a bit sort of shrill and a bit erratic sometimes.
She's got some good backers, though.
Yes, she does. And but this is it. This is how the model works. So, for example, if you look at the UK, just by way of contrast, you have multiple donors of considerable wealth to Farage's Reform UK party. And let's not forget now that Farage is now facing his own right-wing rival and former colleague, Robert Lowe, who's funding another right-wing party that's even to the right of Farage, known as the Restore Party. So you've got Reform and you've got Restore, and money is coming in there too from wealthy donors. So it's a tendency in this particular field to see individuals of certain wealth seeing a chance to mix up the system and get something probably conciliatory to them. I mean, it's no accident that someone like Gina Reinhardt is backing Hansen, because at least, under Hansen offers a kind of a Trump-like vision of minimal regulations for corporations, minimal interest in environmental regulations, that sort of thing. So it's no accident that that's happened.
So where does this leave so-called democracy in Western countries?
Oh, I'm not so negative about democracy in Western countries. I think the whole point ultimately is that a parliamentary system has to be as representative as possible. And so even if you don't necessarily like, or you feel a bit of concern by an individual who will vote for someone like Hansen, I think in the Australian context, people are voting for various reasons. You know, I think the Australian approach to this is kind of a real rag bag of things. It's, I've been looking at some of the material about this, be it the Vox Pops or be it anything like that, and it's a mixture of things. It's sort of, we'll give her a go. Yes, she's got some unsavory opinions, but she's good on, for example, regulating AI. She's coming up with a policy like that, which is interesting. She's one of the first ones to actually openly articulate some kind of measure where, AI cannot be, you can't let the likes of Anthropic roam around the corridors of Canberra, which is essentially what the Albanese government has done, making deals with these AI titans, and you don't quite have a clue what's going on there. So, the funny thing is people vote for various reasons, and they will probably give her the vote in some instances, but I would not be overly pessimistic to see it all collapse. I think one should be a bit more open-minded about that.
How long would you give it before it collapses?
This is the interesting thing. I have a sneaking suspicion that what will happen, because this will be the first time that One Nation will campaign, at least if I follow Hansen correctly on this point, in every seat, if not every seat, then certainly most seats across the country in the lower house, and it certainly will put in a showing in the upper house. But what will be interesting is to see whether they can negotiate the nightmares which other major parties have had to do, of vetting and going through their particular candidates, because I dare say there'll be the odd rather unsavory candidate being pre-selected. So I suspect, and remember, there's a lot of time yet to the next election, so something may well prove rather electorally interesting up to that point. So first of all, I give it that. So there's a lot to happen till the next election in terms of what might happen there on the route. And then once in power, there's always the issue of how, Hansen has a history of being a bit autocratic with the tendencies, and her members tend to leave at some point. They tend to sort of abandon the party. So whether she can maintain a unified front is probably the biggest question as to whether she can maintain that sort of party discipline.
And also to find enough people to fill all those seats, both lower and upper house. It's a fair few, isn't it?
Yeah, there is, but when you consider, I would say that when it comes down to it, because there will be people sufficiently irritated and annoyed with the circumstances of what's happening at the moment to probably run. But it's one thing to put up your hand; it's another thing then to actually, of course, either have the resources or the discipline to go through with it. And I know myself, having campaigned in 2013 for a Senate seat for Victoria for the WikiLeaks party, that's an exhausting, tiring process where it does involve a lot of people as well and many factors in the campaign. So this is just the beginning of something that will be very interesting to see. And there will be some surprises, but I would suggest that in the long term, this is the sort of fire that can actually start ebbing after a while.
Not just the candidacy part of it, but getting into Parliament and understanding all the intricacies of parliamentary life.
Well, yes, but that's part of it. That's the nature of representatives to Parliament. And you'll start finding soon afterwards that deals have to be done. You can't maintain an elevated standing, however demagogic you want to be. You have to start. And that's the other thing you should add. Hansen has had to, when things needed to be done, deals have had to be made and whatnot. Not all the voting patterns suggest either extreme behaviour or irrational behavior at all. I think a lot of this can, eventually there's a certain kind of pragmatic streak that has to be acknowledged, and that's the sort of thing that tends to creep out into politics.
From Pauline Hanson to Gaza and the UN report on Israel's deliberately targeting of Gaza children, part of genocide, part of war crimes, part of everything. We've had reports like this before over the last 2.5 years, but nothing seems to be done or changed.
Again, I think one of these things is that the record on this, of course, is bulking, and Israel is simply becoming less and less, its policies and its approach is becoming less and less palatable and dare I say it, riskier for example, be it corporations investing in Israel, be it, for example, countries engaged in defense arrangements with Israel. So even though there is still this, official standing, if you like, say from the EU, from the EU Commission or the European Commission and the official allied list, if you like, it should not be forgotten that Israel is now, at an all-time unpopular level. It's to such an extent that it even looks comical when you start looking at J.D. Vance, Vice President J.D. Vance of the U.S. and even Donald Trump openly castigating, their closest military allies. So I would say that when it comes down to the issue of the conduct and so on, these are not reports, the Independent International Commission of Inquiry that you mentioned, which incidentally also published a report last year, which concluded that Israel had committed acts of genocide in Gaza during its campaign. These are things that still count. They still matter. People who make agreements or investments in Israel or want to conduct business with Israel are at risk, for either cancellation of contract or isolation or whatever it might be. So there are tangible things beyond the simple kind of sense of, well, Israel is not being totally isolated and totally sanctioned and all that. There are still incremental things being done there.
Well, the Australian government's been under pressure for a long time to acknowledge the trade that they're doing with Israel on weapons. They might be now somehow being forced to recognise and name what weapons they are sending to Israel?
Yes, this is something I certainly hope so in due course. It's been a strange situation to see and quite lamentable to see the way Australian policy towards Israel on this point has, call it developed, call it shaped, and I don't really know quite what to say about it other than it's just deeply unsatisfactory because the initial reluctance, and it continues, of course, the reluctance to designate it genocidal or even mention that the commission of grave war crimes and so on, and the fact that withholding energy supplies, withholding food, humanitarian aid and so on are also war crimes and arguably part of a pattern of willful intent in the commission of genocide. So the Albanese government has continued this kind of hedging, and also when it comes to dealing with local politics, the fact that the Israeli connection here cannot be dismissed or extricated from policies on anti-Semitism, for example, or the queries of investigating the expression of views, for example, on the university campuses. It's all linked in Israeli policy and what it does in the broader international diaspora and so forth. So I think it's been very unsatisfactory the way the Albanese government has been pursuing its policy with Israel. And don't forget, the Australian Defence Forces do have close relationships with the IDF. They do have contracts with the IDF, and and they do have constant interest in Israeli technology. And even though she's not, just to add to that, even though she's not herself involved in a government position, she's nonetheless very notable because she is Australia's wealthiest individual. Gina Rinehart, who we mentioned, touched on before, recently gave an address in Townsville, and some people in that address were from the military, the so-called News Corp Bush Summit, which is held every year. And she said that there was certain land outside Townsville, roughly, I think, 50 kilometers outside Townsville in the area called Prairie, which is set for wind turbines. But that area, she suggested, forget wind turbines, these bat and bird maiming devices. Well, how about giving that land to the IDF or Israeli military specialists to manufacture drone technology there so that we can then have it and use it to protect our, guess what, infrastructure for mining and assets like that. So that's what she's obsessed about that. So, you know, it's there, it lingers, this relationship with Israel amongst people in power and of power. So I do wonder sometimes, you know, whether the incoherence of Australian policy is very, very very unpleasant, I would say.
And what a lot of people don't realise is that the use of Pine Gap by the United States on surveillance and in their wars, that I've been told by a reliable source that that information goes to Israel as well.
Well, yes, because the targeting aspect of this, and because Pine Gap essentially is a targeting facility, it's a signals intelligence facility, which is only ever expanding, it never goes the other way. It is one of the largest U.S. signals facilities outside the United States, and it's invaluable for targeting operations for the U.S. Army. It's invaluable in terms of drone strikes, and it's invaluable in the sharing of intelligence with other member states. And, of course, Israel is a critical part of the defense strategy or the defense relationship with the United States. And, yes, it is very considerable anecdotal evidence to suggest that information is being shared when it comes to targeting, certainly the use of drones against targets in Gaza. And the link with Pine Gap, you know, is something that is very, it will be very hard to refute that.
And finally, Binoy, the treatment of the people on the flotilla, the recent flotilla to Gaza, which was intercepted in international waters, as they always are. The Australian government seems to be making moves to inquire into that. Are you satisfied that it will be an independent investigation?
Look, I'm not sure about that. I do know that mutterings have been made about this from the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong. She has met with a number of the detainees, Australian detainees, that were on the particular vessel as part of the global Sumut flotilla, who were apprehended in May by the Israeli security forces, and four individuals in particular, four female activists, I think Juliet Lamont, Neve O'Connor, Gemma O'Toole, and Luca Lamont, are actually saying that they had been assaulted, sexually assaulted, physically assaulted by the Israeli forces. This was denied vehemently by officials, IDF officials and security officials and so on. They have accused the activists in question of being provocateurs who cannot be trusted. But at the very least, what Senator Wong has done is that is actually to meet with these individuals and to, with senior members of the Australian Federal Police, to conduct an investigation into this. Now, where this goes, it's hard to say. The AFP are going to be conducting or are conducting investigations into this, and that will be an interesting thing, because once they are not, at least I hope, will not feel under any pressure from the Australian government to come up with one solution or the other, that hopefully when they submit their report of findings to the Australian government, that something will be done. But that's the problem. We don't know at what point, once the AFP identifies if there's relevant evidence and so on, what can then be done by the federal government or what will be done. But it's very clear that already certain ministers in the Israeli cabinet, the current Israeli cabinet, including the notorious National Security and Police Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was very openly abusing victims, abusing activists with, you know, camera footage was taken off him once the activists had been apprehended, and then he was there proudly holding the Israeli flag and abusing several of the activists. I think this just demonstrates that particular, the urgency of dealing with that kind of situation. And, you know, Ben-Gvir can be relied on to supply evidence whether he wants to or not, because he's very open about the brutality of the Israeli prison service, not merely to the security services to the activists, but very open about the brutality towards Palestinian detainees, which has reached the levels of, you know, appalling levels of torture, also sexual abuse and a range of other extraordinary things that they're being done to them.
If not the AFP, what other organisation would you be happy doing an inquiry into this?
Well, you see, any other human, any of the human rights organisations would be fine, but I would say that the most, you know, ideally an appropriate body would be the International Criminal Court. The problem is, though, that because Israel in this case is not, you know, a member of the court, that makes it very difficult. So the only reason why the ICC managed to issue arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, is because Israeli actions and activities have taken place on Palestinian territory, Palestinian soil, and Palestinian, or the, for what, as it were, the rudiments of Palestinian statehood have signed on to the ICC, the Palestinian Authority, and so on. So for that reason, the ICC has jurisdiction. But when it comes to this, because the vessels were intercepted outside in international waters, and they were heading to Gaza, yes, but they were intercepted beforehand, it's a bit hard to sort of see how that can be done. But, you know, international condemnation and pressure on Israeli authorities to do something is ideally the best way. But unfortunately, given the attitude of the Israeli authorities claiming that these activists, as I said, are just provocateurs and cannot be trusted, that makes an Israeli approach unlikely.
Well, then what's the point of having international waters if they can, if a country can do what they do every time there is a flotilla?
Well, absolutely. Well, I agree. I mean, what's been interesting about the interception of these vessels is that they have been openly condemned by various European states about this, specifically in the context of violating maritime law. But again, unfortunately, the Israeli approach to this, and to a large extent they have been shown to be right over the years, is to see how far they can push matters in terms of impunity and to see how far they can go. They've been shown up as you know, falling short of that impunity idea because of things such as the ICC's effort to arraign Netanyahu and Gallant, but, and also, I should add, by South Africa's efforts, joined by multiple other countries, in seeking to hold Israel to account for its activities, its alleged genocidal actions in Gaza. But when it comes to these kind of actions, there's still, it's still rather difficult to pursue it. It could also be, now that I mentioned this to you, citizens of each of the countries represented, of those people who were allegedly tortured and so on, they could file complaints with the ICJ as a, on a state-by-state basis. So they could make a complaint as violations of international law, and they could bring these complaints to the ICJ against Israel because Israel is a member. But that would take years. So, but that's another opportunity there.
Thank you once again, Binoy.
Always a pleasure, Jan. Thank you.
And Dr. Binoy Campmark is a senior lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
CR celebrating 50 years.
This June we'll be asking for your donations to support 3CR.
Your donation during Radiothon keeps the station radical and enables us to give voice to our community for another year.
All donations over $2 are tax deductible.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au. Show your support by donating this June.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Regular listeners to Tuesday Home Time will remember an interview a few weeks ago with recently retired Adelaide QC and member of FOPA, in which he raised concerns at the impact of the federal government's new hate laws on groups and individuals who criticise Israel. And he gave the instance of the long-running BDS presence in Adelaide's Rundle Mall, and the fact that they had cancelled their weekly event for fear of being prosecuted. Today I'm speaking with another member of FOPA, Mike Kissam, who is the Vice President of the group, about the reaction to the hate laws. But first I asked Mike to talk about his long involvement in working for Palestine and found out that it stems from his Lebanese parents who came to Australia post-World War II. And I asked Mark how influential his parents were in his support for Palestine.
My father didn't have much of an education, but he was an intelligent man. He followed international politics, and he was very conscious of the fate of the Arab world during the 20th century and the impact of war and colonialism on the Arab world. And the place that received the harshest impact was, of course, Palestine, because the establishment of Israel was a colonial project, facilitated by the British, but basically it was European settlement that displaced the Palestinian people. And so I had an awareness of that, and then my own interest proceeded when I recognised what a huge injustice had been done to the Palestinian people.
And when you say the impact on Palestine, a big impact on Lebanon as well.
Yeah, Lebanon has suffered because of its proximity to Israel and Palestine. So the creation of Israel meant Palestinian refugees were dispersed across the Arab world, and about half the Palestinian population became refugees in 1948, about 750,000 people, and a number went to Lebanon. And over the course of a couple of decades, Palestinian refugee camps became centres of guerrilla resistance to Israel. And what this meant was that the Israelis would both punish those organisations by bombing refugee camps and assassinating Palestinian leaders, but they would also cause damage to the host countries, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, over various decades at different times. So Lebanon suffered by virtue of hosting a Palestinian population and Palestinian resistance organisations, which were aiming to achieve the return of the Palestinians to their country. And the Lebanese political setup was such that it was a country that was constituted of about 18 different religious groups, and it was sort of a precarious balance, and the tensions of the pressure from Israel and the presence of the Palestinian resistance movement, other issues like the Cold War, placed strains on Lebanon, which ended up in a civil war, which went from 75 to 90. So, and Lebanon has never really recovered from that. And there's also been Israeli invasions of Lebanon in the late 70s, in 82, then in 2006, and now more recently. And these Israeli attacks have had a devastating and long-term impact. Massive amounts of destruction of transport and housing infrastructure, high death tolls, destruction of hospitals, the sorts of things we've seen in Gaza have been visited on Lebanon and are currently being visited on Lebanon. So Lebanon has paid a high price for being adjacent to Israel, for supporting Palestinian rights, and in recent times for opposing the genocide that's been unfolding in Gaza at the hands of Israel.
I'd imagine you would have had, or still have, relatives in Lebanon, even though your parents came to Australia. How many times have you been there?
Look, I visited Lebanon twice. I went in 1970 as a boy, and that was before the Civil War started in 75. And then I returned in 1985, which was while the Civil War was still going on. It's a small country. It's a beautiful country, but the effects of war have been quite profound on Lebanon, both on its people and on the visible the landscape, the cities, and that sort of thing.
Were you able to visit Palestine on either of those trips?
And not at that time. I visited Palestine in 2014. And that was my first and only visit. And I went through Ben Gurion Airport and then into Palestine, went to Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, Nablus, the major Palestinian population centres. And it wasn't a very long trip, but it was quite instructive.
I'm sure the memories are still with you.
As somebody who'd followed the issue for a very long time and studied on it, there wasn't a lot of what I saw and heard which was actually new to me. But it's quite different when you meet people who are living it. I remember when we went to Hebron, which is a shocking place to visit because an Israeli settlement has been stuck in the middle of a large Palestinian city. And this settlement, with all its demands for security and exclusive access, has had a huge impact on Hebron. And I remember we met a guy who, Palestinian guy, who'd been severely beaten by Israelis without any justification, and he'd been crippled by it, and he'd had to undergo successive surgeries, but he basically had to spend his life on his bed all day long. And we met another fellow in Hebron who was a well-known guide for foreigners coming to look at the reality of Hebron, a guy called Issa Amro, who was a Christian Palestinian. Incredibly brave guy. And we were walking down a street in Hebron called Shahada Street, which was used to be part of the commercial area. And it's a street that Palestinians aren't allowed to walk on, but Israelis can. And so Issa had to stay off the road up on an embankment. And one of these Israeli settlers came along and tried with a sidearm, pistol on his hip, wanting to know who we were and this sort of thing. And the courage of people like Issa Amro and other Palestinians who try and show the outside world the reality of, you know, the settlement project and the whole colonial project, that their courage is quite remarkable, that they have to deal with these people, armed Israeli soldiers at checkpoints, these ideological vicious settlers, and the Palestinians aren't armed, but the Israeli soldiers and the settlers are. And they have to deal with them, and they can be intimidated, they can be beaten up, they can be arrested, and things can happen out of view of cameras. And yet they still persevere. So the courage of some of the people we met was just truly, truly remarkable.
So that's just some examples of what you call living it.
Yes, absolutely.
When did you join FOPA?
About 20 years ago, so not long after FOPA was formed. So I've been interested in Palestine since I was a boy, and I've been an advocate for justice for Palestine for nearly 50 years. And over that time, there's been different organisations that have existed in Adelaide to support justice for Palestine, raise awareness about Palestine. And FOPA has been probably the most successful of those organisations. And yes, I've been involved for around 20 years and I'm now a member of the executive.
BDS, is that a FOPA or is BDS part of FOPA?
So BDS, which is the divestment sanctions movement, has been a reality for over 20 years as well. And it's originated in Palestine from Palestinian non-government organisations that were looking for ways that people in the outside world could have an impact on the Israeli government and its policies, because diplomacy and international law and war had not made a difference in stopping Israeli colonisation and securing Palestinian rights. So the BDS movement has, you know, had great support around the world. And in Adelaide, AFOPA has been supportive of BDS. And we've had a group which regularly would distribute information and speak to people. And one of our main shopping strips, which is Rundle Mall in the central business district of Adelaide. And so the BDS group has been part of AFOPA. And, you know, we have been supportive of BDS for a long time.
Yet 3 months ago or so, you ceased your weekly forays into Rundle Mall. What was the cause of that?
The introduction of the new hate speech or hate group laws by the federal government in January, in the aftermath of the Bondi massacre, has created a great deal of uncertainty for pro-Palestine activists as to what you can and cannot say or do. And in part, this is probably deliberate, but the laws are hard to follow. They're complex. We've been told they're contradictory in some areas, but they were pushed through very quickly with pressure from the Israel lobby. And what it meant for our BDS people was that just a straightforward support for BDS, advocating boycott, divestment, sanctions, peaceful protests, talking to people about the issue, was potentially going to see them subject to some of these laws, which for some parts carry heavy fines and up to 7 years of imprisonment for doing something which is basically political advocacy, not inciting violence, not racist, not disruptive. And so the BDS group decided in collaboration with AFOPA that they would hold off for a while and see how things panned out. And that's what happened, but now they're back on the streets after a few months.
What happened to change their mind?
The focus has changed to some extent, in that now the focus is on talking specifically about the reality that Palestinians are facing in all its dimensions, whether it be in the West Bank and the loss of homes, the demolition of homes, the arbitrary detentions, or whether it be the various horrors of Gaza. So it's now a more general issue that's being talked about without specifically including BDS.
Do you get any pressure from the local government? As you say, you're there in the middle of Rundle Mall on a Saturday. Do they acquiesce to what you do? And also the state government, do you get any flack from them?
Look, largely we have had a good relationship with both the Adelaide City Council and the South Australian government. Our protests have been peaceful. We get a very good response from the public, and we're not disruptive. And so we've had many years of operating in the main shopping strip. And also in terms of the protests that have been occurring on a very regular basis since October 7th, we've had a good relationship with the state government, which has not gone down the path of some of the other governments in seeking to curtail protest activity around Palestine.
Well, that's one form of censorship for your BDS. Another form is to do with your bike ride. Now, that bike ride's been going for a number of years now, and there's been a few obstacles placed in your way. There's a new one this year, isn't there?
Yeah, it was. It's a strange story. There's a group called Big Ride for Palestine, which is connected to us, and we support them. And they're essentially a group of bike riders who try and promote awareness of Palestine through their cycling group, which they go out as a group regularly, and they have jerseys which have Palestine and Palestinian colours, Palestinian flag on them. And again, they're being quite well received by motorists and other people at events where they participate. And it's been a very positive experience by and large, although we've struck difficulties on a couple of occasions, but the most recent has been sort of a bit bizarre because they were seeking to get winter jerseys produced in the same sort of designs that had before, but specifically for winter. And they'd approached a sportswear manufacturer and, given them all the details, and things seemed to be in place. And then there was a silence from the manufacturer, who they haven't wanted to name publicly, and, no attempts to finalise the order or sort out payment. And when the Big Ride for Palestine group approached the manufacturer, they were given reasons like the design was politically biased and they felt they couldn't undertake it. So there was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, but essentially the design had nothing on it that was illegal, had nothing on it that was racist, had nothing on it that was inflammatory. It had a Palestinian flag, Free Palestine on the jerseys, and Australian Friends of Palestine logo. And it hadn't been problematic before, but this designer had said yes and then gone quiet on it. And then we found out that it was politically motivated. And they described the item as being a politically biased item. So I don't know, about any other ethnic or national groups that might want to have their flags or logos on their clothing. But what became apparent was that the decision by the manufacturer was very much a political decision. And we were left having to go and find another manufacturer. But the big thing about it was that this was something that we saw as a type of quiet censorship, which we think there's probably a lot more of than the more overt cases that get into the media, where because you have some advocacy for Palestine, even the name Palestine, associated with a product or an event, in this case with a jersey and a riding group, that doors are shut. Things that should normally happen as a matter of course suddenly become difficult. And it was instructive.
Do you know of any other subtle censorship going on, particularly in South Australia?
Look, the sorts of things that we've had in the past, and the thing about the subtle censorship is it's often hard to prove. So you'll be attempting to get a booking for a venue and it'll be difficult for no apparent reasons, or there'll be a venue booked for an event and then it'll be cancelled at the last minute, forcing us to scramble for another venue rather for the event. Dealing with politicians is one of the trickier parts, because there's a tendency with politicians either to not be responsive, and here we're talking about the last couple of years being in the context of an active genocide that's been televised around the world and mobilized people in huge numbers around the world. And politicians are either don't want to know or make decisions that are designed to shut down criticism of Israel, shut down dissent, with no consultation with either the Palestinian community or Palestinian advocacy groups, but often with clear collaboration with pro-Israel groups, which is sometimes published and sometimes we find out about it through other, indirectly. So that sort of thing happens.
And of course, with groups such as yours, to have to continually fight these battles to or against censorship, it takes away the energies to focus on or to promote what is actually happening in Palestine, as you've just said.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I mean, that's been the case, particularly with some of the high-profile cases, your Mary Kostakidis, your Antoinette Latouf's, where Grace Tame, where people are penalised for their political views and their energy is taken up in defending themselves. But what we don't often see from the pro-Israel groups, they won't come out and say, well, look, we disagree with what you're saying. We demand that to you public debate. We demand you defend your views publicly. This is not the path they choose. They find ways of silencing people rather than engaging in public debate and proving their point. And they go down that path because it's very hard to defend an apartheid state. It's hard to defend a genocide. But this is what we see.
Well, through all this, FOPRA is a very influential little group in Adelaide, and you've had some pretty spectacular speakers come to your yearly lectures and the different venues and things that you have on every year. It attracts a fair bit of attention.
Yeah, FOPRA has been a very hard-working and successful group. I mean, we punch above our weight. We have an annual lecturer, Edward Said Memorial Lecture, and we've been fortunate to have some very significant speakers from Robert Fisk, the international journalist, to Noam Chomsky, to Gideon Levy, to Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur for the occupied territories, very significant speakers. And we've been also very successful in maintaining public protests over the period of the genocide. We were initially doing it every couple of weeks with significant attendance. And FOPRA is also part of the national Palestinian solidarity movement. And so, we have been engaged in campaigns initiated by the Australian Palestine Advocacy Network. So we do our best to make an impact on the system, to raise awareness about the reality over there, because the current trajectory is disastrous for the Palestinians, but it's not going to be any good for the Israelis. Do they want to live in an apartheid state that's constantly at war because people are resisting what's being done to them? I mean, that's the future of Israel if it keeps going the way it's going. So FOPRA has worked very hard to try and raise awareness of the reality over there, but it's very much an uphill battle.
Finally, Mike, on a personal level, must be very satisfying for you to support the Palestinians, and I imagine you have Palestinians living in South Australia.
Yes, we certainly do. It's only a small community. Some have been here for some time, and we've also had recent arrivals from Gaza since the start of the genocide. And look, we're very happy to be able to support local Palestinians in Australia. A lot of them have been through terrible things in recent times, but even the people that have been here much longer are people that are a people in exile. They didn't want to leave their homes. They've made new homes in Australia, but the ongoing injustice in their former homeland is something that's always very close to them. And we're very pleased to be able to support them in their struggle for recognition of what's happening over there, and work with them for justice for Palestinians.
Thank you so much for today, Mike.
Thank you, Jen.
I've been speaking with Mike Kassam, who's the Vice President of AFOPA, Australian Friends of Palestine, Association.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
Outrage has filled the Western media in recent weeks over the death of a young Iranian Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini, who was arrested by the so-called morality police and died in police custody. Whether as a result of a stroke resulting from a recent brain surgery, as the authorities claim, or as her family claim, she was beaten. But what have you heard in the same Western media of the deliberate killing of Palestinian children? Six in the space of a few weeks by armed men and women obeying the orders of a regime illegally occupying their lands. And just before that, 7-year-old Rayan Suleiman died of fear, sheer terror, as he was being chased by Israeli soldiers. His heart gave out. This hypocrisy is so blatant that some might find it unbelievable, but unfortunately for the Palestinian families, it's not. I spoke yesterday with Jessica Morrison, the Executive Officer of APAN, Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network. Jessica, it's reached the point of the State of Palestine calling on the United Nations Secretary General and the Special Representative of the Secretary General for Children and the Armed Conflict Secretary General to provide special protection for Palestinian children. But can we first talk about a UN Commission of Inquiry?
Yeah, so it's an ongoing Commission of Inquiry. It gave its first report earlier this year, and this week, in the last week, it has just released its report, its second report. So the first report said the major responsibility has to sit with Israel because of its ongoing military occupation, its unequal treatment of Palestinians and the impunity for any of their breaches of international law. So we must call on Israel to be accountable. That was their first report earlier this year. Their second report released on Friday says that Israel's occupation is inherently illegal. So occupations are allowed in international law. It's kind of seen as a temporary military measure as, you know, things happen. But Israel's occupation of Palestinians' land is not temporary. It has been going on for decades and decades. And it therefore is depriving a Palestinian self-determination in perpetuity and therefore is inherently illegal. And this UN Commission of Inquiry said Israel must be referred to the International Court of Justice by the UN. So this is a massive report. The Commission of Inquiry has three eminent conservative, one might say, lawmakers. One of them is Chris Sidoti, who's an Aussie guy who served on the Human Rights Council, I mean, as a Human Rights Commissioner here in Australia. So this is not a group of kind of 3CR listeners, as wonderful as we all are. This is a group of eminent lawmakers who have said Israel's occupation is inherently illegal and has been perpetuating these horrendous things against Palestinians.
Where does it go from there?
Well, I mean, I think what we're seeing in terms of what's the discourse of the United Nations, like even the United Nations, as conservative it is starting to use stronger and stronger language. Because, you know, I mean, we're living through the Russian occupation of Ukraine. We know what the response to military occupation should be. And on paper, it's exactly the same to Israel's occupation of the West Bank. But in practice, what Russia's facing and what Israel's facing are completely different. So I think now we're finding that even at the United Nations level, they're like, our annual condemnations of Israel clearly aren't enough, because we've been saying it for 77 years and Israel keeps on going. So whether it's enough to see action, we're yet to see. But at the United Nations, both this and a UN Special Rapporteur report, who for the first time, in my understanding, called Israel's occupation settler colonialism and talked about that needing to be dismantled as the key framework, not negotiation, then, you know, we're seeing a shift. So hopefully the shift in language will also see a shift in action.
What about the situation for the children in Palestine at the moment, where an increasing number of children are being slain by Israeli defence, so-called defence forces?
Yeah, Jan, it's been a horrific time in the West Bank. Just a warning for listeners, this is really distressing stuff. So last month, a 7-year-old healthy boy was walking home from school and he got chased by an Israeli soldier. And if you've got a 7-year-old in your life, you know how little these wee ones are. He got chased by an Israeli soldier until his heart gave out. Like, he seems to have literally died of fear. Another 12-year-old boy was shot in the stomach. A 12-year-old boy was shot in the stomach by Israeli forces, held on for a few weeks and then died. Every week we're seeing scores of Palestinian children injured, arrested and killed. There's been 100 Palestinians at least in the West Bank who have been shot and killed by Israeli forces. Deadliest year in the West Bank in a long, long time. So for Palestinian children, men and women, suddenly the Israeli occupation, and look, a military occupation is inherently violent. Whether it's checkpoints, you know, impacting on what you do, farmland becoming a closed military zone. I mean, they're used to living under violence, Palestinians, and we're all too used to Palestinians living under violence. But in the last few months, Israel has ratcheted up its control to horrendous levels. And in the last couple of weeks, things have got even more horrific. In the response to Israeli soldiers being killed, Israel has literally put under siege a refugee camps in Jerusalem and towns in the north of the West Bank. These places are supposed to be under full Palestinian control under the Oslo Accords. You know, so supposedly Israel's supposed to keep their nose out of all these places, but instead there have been near nightly raids. In the middle of the night, Israeli jeeps are going through people's neighbourhoods and yanking people out of bed. So at least 2,000 people have been arrested. 2,000. At the moment, if I've got my maths right, there's 5,000 Palestinians in the West Bank who are in jail, 10% of which have no charges, which I think is, you know, 0.1%. One in every 1,200 Palestinians in the West Bank are in an Israeli jail. And if we can start to think what proportion of that are children, you know, there's a huge... Anyway, the imprisonment, the injuring and the killings in the last few months have just been horrific.
Are you aware of what happens to these people when they are dragged out of their beds in the middle of the night? What's the process after that?
Yeah, look, it's been really well documented. UNICEF has particularly been scathing with Israel about how it has treated children. But we now know that the majority of children are taken away from the West Bank into a settlement or into 48 Israel. Against UN conventions. So people are taken out of their own jurisdictions, most of which report physical assaults or threats, many of whom are held in solitary confinement. The vast majority do not have access to a lawyer. Many are questioned in Hebrew, a language that they don't understand. Many are asked to sign statements in Hebrew, a language they don't understand. And are told that, you know, we all know that over 99% of Palestinians, once arrested and charged with something, over 99% of them are found guilty. So to be arrested in the West Bank is to have any presumption of innocence dropped, is to have any of your basic human rights evaporated, to have any sense of fair justice or fair treatment evaporate. So this is not people who are being arrested because there's a body of evidence. Israel is regularly sweeping up numbers and numbers of Palestinians in what can only be seen as collective punishment.
And, of course, we have to acknowledge, Jessica, that it's not only the Israeli soldiers who are attacking the Palestinian people, it's the settlers, and in many cases they're worse than the Israeli soldiers.
Oh, there's been an alarming increase in violence by settlers. In the last 2 weeks, there's been at least 100 incidences of settler violence. And we're not talking about somebody yelling words across the street. We're talking about mobs of extremist Jewish settlers who are rampaging through Palestinian towns and villages and cities, brandishing clubs, throwing rocks in shop fronts, throwing rocks through Palestinian cars. There was an incident of where Israeli soldiers were attacked by settlers because the Israeli soldiers were trying to stop the settlers throwing rocks at Palestinian moving cars. So there is a whole sense where there are mobs of Israeli settlers emboldened by Israeli politics who are going and attacking people. I saw a photograph of a volunteer who was trying to help with the olive harvest being attacked by a group of men with sticks. So out in the olive harvests, as well as in the refugee camps that are being locked down by Israel and the towns that are being locked down by Israel, there are settlers thinking they can get away with the most horrific of violence.
And then you have so many people in indefinite detention.
Yeah, so Israel is one of the largest users of detention without trial. So at a snap of a finger, you can hold a Palestinian in jail for 6 months. If you want to go before a military judge, a soldier, then they can, 6 months at a time, just keep extending it. We've got Palestinians who've been in jail for years without charge, or Palestinians who are regularly in jail for 6 months at a time without charge. 10% of the Palestinians are sitting in an Israeli jail have never been charged with anything. So not a trumped-up charge, not a charge with no evidence, but no charge at all.
Just to focus on those who are shot by the military, whether they're children or adults, I have heard the stories that even if an ambulance is called, they can't get through. The Israelis block the ambulance coming. And I'd imagine any other people who might be able to help them are also blocked from trying to attend to those who have been injured.
Yeah, absolutely. All those things are true. All those things are true. I mean, I've been in a Palestinian hospital myself, and the doctors and professionals are all amazing people. The issue is what happened, and often there are really solid facilities. But often what the issue is, as you say, Israel stops people from actually being able to access medical treatment. And many Palestinians who are shot by Israeli forces are left to, and it's gross language, are left to bleed out on the street because Israel refuses to allow people to access medical treatment. Shireen Abu Akleh, you know, the most esteemed, loved Palestinian journalist who was shot in the head by Israeli forces during these escalations in the last few months, who Israel tried to say was Palestinians that shot her. It's very clear now it was a deliberate, targeted killing by an Israeli soldier. She was lying there on the ground. And Israeli, you know, there's video footage of her lying on the ground, bleeding out, before any Palestinian medics were allowed to attend to her.
Let's talk about what's been happening here in Australia in the last couple of weeks with the ALP government reversing the decision by the Morrison government of recognising West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It's been an absolute furore by some of the Jewish organisations. What was the legality of Morrison doing it in the first place?
Well, this is the third small decision that Labor has made to start to bring Australia back into the international consensus, which, as we've been talking about, isn't a bold, brave consensus. It's just a status quo consensus. So the status quo consensus, which has operated since 1948, is that we don't know what's going to happen to Jerusalem. You know, the UN plan said it should be a shared international city, a corpus separatum, because it's so precious to so many people. So that's kind of the status quo. We don't know what's happening to Jerusalem. Israel took unilaterally the western half in 1948, took unilaterally the eastern half in a military occupation in 1967. We all know those as facts on the ground. And so until Trump came along, the world said, we've got a consensus. We need to, you know, we don't know what's happening with Jerusalem yet. We need to wait and see. And then Trump went along and said, sure, if Israel says it's their eternal and undivided capital, let them have it as their eternal and undivided capital, just completely obliterating any of the international norms and consensus. So during the Wentworth by-election with a significant number of Jewish voters, you know, Dave Sharma, who was a former ambassador to Israel, he actually acted as the Australian ambassador for Israel. So he was the Liberal candidate. He stood beside Scott Morrison, and Scott Morrison said, well, maybe we'll do the same. So there was an uproar, as you can imagine. And, you know, they finally did a process after the announcement and went, oh, goodness, where can we politically land? So they made a decision that nobody was happy with. They said, we recognise West Jerusalem is Israel's. So Israel are like, what do you mean? All of Jerusalem's ours. It's all ours. And Palestinians are like, what? And the rest of the international community are like, what? Nobody talks about that. So that became Australian policy under the Morrison government. So Australia went back to the international consensus, which is, we don't know what's happening with Jerusalem yet. We need to wait and see. So sure, their timing was off. It was a Jewish religious holiday. But the way that many of the pro-Israel groups responded was that it was a deliberate smack in the face rather than return to the status quo. And this sort of manufactured outrage is absolutely disgusting and should not be used to stifle conversations about the substantive issue, which is that Israel is occupying Jerusalem and is smashing international law all over the place. That's the substantive issue that we must be talking about. And you know, there was certainly, you know, we saw across Melbourne mainstream newspapers, Jewish people saying, great decision, so glad they've done it. Mainstream Jewish organisations, non-Zionist ones, said, great, thank you for doing it. We're back in the international consensus. There's a chance for fairness now. So actually, the extreme right wing, who are being made to see being seen as the mainstream, the extreme right wing of the Jewish community, who are being quoted as outraged.
So do we have to wait now for the United Nations General Assembly, or do we have to wait for the International Court of Justice to move on this issue, or what's the next step?
Well, certainly Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza do not think so. So Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are undergoing mass civil disobedience campaigns. They're sick of waiting for the United Nations and they're sick of waiting for the international community to support their basic human rights to self-determination. So certainly there are waves of protests and Palestinians are standing up and refusing to comply with the Israeli military. So I think for those of us in the international community, absolutely we need to look at what's happening at the United Nations, and we're about to see UN General Assembly votes, and let's hope Australia makes another small decision to respect Palestinian rights and change Australia's voting pattern, which in the last, you know, decade has been pretty dismal. As a first step, yes, let's see some good voting in the General Assembly. But we must not let that be the only thing that happens, because there's been the votes in the UN General Assembly for decades calling on Israel to stop its settlement, calling on Israel to withdraw from the territories that it occupied in 1967, calling on Israel to be accountable for its actions all over the place, and it has not. So we cannot say the United Nations is the only thing. You know, Australia should be recognising Palestine, absolutely, as a symbolic step. But as the UN Special Rapporteur said, as the Commission of Inquiry report said, we need to actually follow up these words with action. As we were willing and are willing to sanction Russia for what they're doing in the Ukraine, surely similar actions must come with similar consequences, and Israel must be accountable for what it's doing in Palestine. So we must be far more proactive as an international community to stop these horrific injustices.
And we should be also calling on the mainstream media to actually report what's going on in Palestine. We have daily and daily, as you said, reports on what's happening in Ukraine, but the situation in Palestine is dire.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think what's been the most distressing for many Palestinians in the last week is about how used to, how business as usual, how same attacks on Palestinians are. So there's been some really solid media coverage in the last couple of weeks, and we need to give them credit for that. There have been some instances where Palestinian opinion pieces, Palestinian voices have been heard. Fantastic. But I think we can also point to many instances where voices of Zionist outrage has been privileged, where the politics and interviewing what politicians have said and ignoring what Palestinians have said has certainly continued. So we certainly need to keep calling on our media to do better in terms of making sure that they are not deliberately or unwittingly buying into, you know, a particular way of telling the story that continues to paint the Jewish people as the victims, rather than, in this case, it's the Palestinians that are the clear victims of Israeli abuses of their human rights.
And as you've said, there are plenty of Jewish people in Australia and all over the world who do not support what Israel is doing to the Palestinians.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for any of the Jewish groups to purport that they speak for everybody, and particularly the Zionist groups to purport that they speak for all Jewish people in Australia, is incredibly insulting, and I'd suggest anti-Semitic. We cannot, you know, we don't think that any other community speaks with one voice. And before the federal election, you know, you had predominantly the teal independents that were promised to be delivered all the Jewish vote if they stood with Israel. But even the kind of Monash University most recent poll suggests that up to a third of the Jewish community in Australia don't even identify as Zionists. And I, you know, I do want to give a shout out to Jewish people who stand with Palestinians, because for them it often costs them a lot, and they lose out for their solidarity in terms of some family relationships and so forth. So all credit to them, because we know it costs them. There are many people in the Jewish community who still think they need to stand with Israel for under anything. So for the growing number of Jewish people who stand with Palestinians, all credit and gratitude to them.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thanks, Dan.
And I've been speaking with Jessica Morrison, who's the Executive Officer of Australia Palestine Advocacy Network, APAN.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Imagine the furor here in Australia and perhaps overseas if human rights organisations such as Oxfam, Amnesty International, Australian Red Cross, Save the Children Australia were violently invaded, equipment and documents stolen, and soldiers welded shut their doors and left. Bad enough if they were Australian soldiers acting on behalf of the Australian government, but these soldiers are the state apparatus of an occupying force, and I'm talking about the Israeli government. Why aren't the world's governments and media screaming of the injustice instead of mostly sitting on their hands, as they usually do when it comes to Israeli human rights abuses? I'm speaking with human rights activist Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees. Stuart, you've called your recent article in Pearls and Irritation, "Terrorist Reoccupied Israel, Issue's Latest License for Thuggery." In the article, you also allude to brutality, racism and slaughter. These actions against the human rights organisations are just the latest in a long list. It's the children who suffer a huge amount of this.
Correct. The children locked up and treated in an appalling way are mostly invisible to the West. You won't see our mainstream media ever covering that because it's military routine. It's the way Israel behaves and nobody's supposed to say anything about it. I mean, the killing by Israel, that gets a little bit of attention, a bit like an Australian cricket score. That's about as much how seriously leading media and politicians take it.
Well, let's talk about these human rights organisations that have been violently shut down. What have you found out?
Well, I mean, they were reputable, they were scrupulous, they did significant research, they exposed the abusive, murderous behaviour of the State of Israel. So if you take an organisation like Al-Haq, which is essentially a human rights organisation, very, very many people from Australia, significant academics and others have worked there, and it's as reputable as Human Rights Watch. But look, this is Israel. Israel's exceptional. Israel can do what it likes. And so they've all been closed, all of them. Similarly, of course, the one which is known as Defend Children International -Palestine, which is the one that the organization that paid particular attention to the evidence about the treatment of arrested children. So all of them are reputable, all of them are reliable, even the CIA. I don't usually go give praise to the CIA, but even the CIA says, you know, there's no evidence that they behaved anything like a terrorist.
You wonder when they'll have in this site next.
Well, any Palestinian, look, the evidence seems to be that they don't really treat the Palestinian people as human, which gives them an entitlement to kill, imprison, torture whom they like. That's why, that's why I've said that if we just call these events human rights abuses, that's such an anodyne use of language, anodyne description, that nobody takes any notice. Let's call the behaviour what it exactly is. I mean, my argument is that with all those titles of the operations against the Palestinians, or in particular the people of Gaza, that this makes the closure of the human rights organisations inevitable. I mean, it was one thing, in a way, by recording all the slaughter of thousands of Palestinians with very, very few Israeli casualties in all the so-called invasions of Gaza. I mean, there was one set of figures that I completely overlooked, and that was what happened in 1948, the Nakba, the expulsion of 750,000 people, the erasure from the face of the earth of 500 villages and urban settlements, which were Palestinian. What happened a few weeks ago in the closure of the human rights organizations is just the latest step following from what happened in 1948.
And we have to recognize that Israel can get away with this because mainly Western countries allow it to be happening?
Well, in particular the United States. I mean, the United States and Israel are barely indistinguishable, one and the same country, if you think about the arms sales of America to Israel. You'd see that the word, you know, Israeli security, American security, you can't distinguish between them. And when the latest closure of all the human rights organizations occurred, the American spokesperson said they were concerned. In other words, they stroked the Israeli politicians with a feather. That was about as far as they would go.
Have you seen a comment by any Australian politician about what's happening?
No, nothing. I haven't seen anything. I mean, no, it's... I've had people write to me and to say, thank you for writing about this. We haven't read anything about it in the mainstream media. In other words, I mean, the Australian mainstream media is pathetic when it comes to basic human rights. But this is actually not about basic human rights. This is about the slaughter of a whole people, the erasure of a whole people. I'm very careful at this point not to use another word. Otherwise, people would be up in arms. But you can guess what I'm talking about.
And also to remember that the Israelis are an occupying force when they do all these deeds against the Palestinians.
Sure. I mean, they break all the rules. They're supposed to, if they're an occupying force, I mean, the Geneva Convention is supposed to have taught them that they're not, you know, apart from anything else, they're not allowed to settle other people there, that they have a particular responsibility for the human rights of the people they occupy. That means nothing, nothing. That's why when the West, of which Israel is supposed to be a part, talks about a human rights order, about a world order, hypocritical.
And in the same week, Israel bombs Syria and sentences a non-government organization's representative to 12 years in jail.
Yep, the sentencing of Al-Halabi. Yeah, I mean, that there's no evidence about his guilt whatsoever. Israeli revenge. I mean, there are all sorts of other examples we could dig up whereby they sentenced people, sentenced Palestinians to long years of imprisonment with no evidence against them. There's a group known as the Palestinian Five who've suffered similarly at the hands of the Israelis. I mean, what is called justice? You only have to read one article a week by Gideon Levy, the wonderful Israeli journalist, to know that the references to the Israeli High Court, the Israeli court system, have very little to do with justice.
And then one of those organisations you were talking about is an organisation which tries to support children, Palestinian children, who have been jailed by Israelis, and they're sentenced in a military court.
They're the only children in the world. I mean, the world is behaving like with bastardry, but the Israelis, they're in the league, top of the league in that respect. They're the only country in the world who put children through a military system. The kids are mostly young people, from, you know, as young as 12. They're there largely, as far as I can make out, for throwing stones. Many of them are shackled, not allowed to see lawyers, not allowed to contact their families. You know, hundreds and hundreds of them arrested and treated in that way every year. And now the organization that's trying to keep a record of this and represent their interests is closed down.
An interview out of the archives, Professor Emeritus Stuart Rees speaking with me in September 2022.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.